hint that her offer was not all it seemed to be. This one was adept at more than just healing weaves, it appeared. Curious, Swan let the aged woman take the basket. They began to walk down the pathway toward the novice's tents. "It's curious," Sharina said, "that such a large disturbance could be caused by such a seemingly simple revelation, wouldn't you say, Swan Sedai?" "Elida's discovery of traveling is an important revelation." "And yet nowhere near as important as the ones rumored to have come during the meeting a few months back, when that man who can channel visited. Odd that this should create such a scene." Swan shook her head. "The thinking of crowds is often odd at first consideration, Sharina. Everyone is still talking about that Ashaman visit, and they're thirsty for more. So they react with excitement at the chance to hear something else. In that way, the great revelations can come in secret, but then cause lesser ones to be received in an explosion of anxiety." "One could put that observation to good use, I should think," Sharina nodded to a group of novices as they passed. "If one wanted to cause worry, that is."
"What are you saying?" Swan asked, eyes narrowing.
"Ashmanila reported first to Lelaine Sedai," Sharina said softly. "I've heard that Lelaine was the one who let the news slip. She spoke it out loud in the hearing of a family of novices while calling for the hall to meet. She also deflected several early calls for the meeting to be sealed to the flame."
"Ah," Swan said. "So that's why."
"I relate only hearsay, of course," Sharina explained, pausing in the shade of a scraggly blackwood tree. "It is probably just foolishness. Why, an Aes Sedai of Lelaine's stature would know that if she let information slip in the hearing of novices, it would soon pass to all willing ears. And in the tower, every ear is willing."
"Exactly, Swan Sedai," Sharina said, smiling.
Lelaine had wanted to create a menagerie of a meeting. She'd wanted novices listening in, and every sister in the camp joining in the discussion. Why? And why was Sharina confiding her very un-novice-like opinions? The answer was obvious. The more threatened the women in the camp felt, the more danger they saw from Elida, the easier it would be for a firm hand to seize control. Though the sisters were indignant now over the mere loss of a closely guarded secret, they would soon realize the danger that Swan had already seen. Soon there would be fear, worry, anxiety. The siege would never work, not now that the Aes Sedai inside it could travel wherever and whenever they wished. Bryn's army at the bridges had become useless. Unless Swan missed her guess, Lelaine would be making certain that everyone else noticed the implications, too.
"She wants us scared," Swan said. "She wants a crisis."
It was clever. Swan should have seen this coming. The fact that she hadn't, and the fact that she'd gotten no wind of Lelaine's plans, also whispered an important fact. The woman might not trust Swan as deeply as she seemed to. Blast! She focused on Sharina. The gray-haired woman stood patiently, waiting as Swan worked through what she'd revealed.
"Why did you tell me this?" Swan asked. "For all you know, I'm Lelaine's lackey."
Sharina raised her eyebrows. "Please, Swan Sedai, these eyes aren't blind, and they see a woman working very hard to keep the Ammerlin's enemies occupied."
"Fine," Swan said. "But you are still exposing yourself for very little reward."
"Little reward?" Sharina asked. "Excuse me, Swan Sedai, but what do you suppose my fate will be if the Ammerlin doesn't return? No matter what she says now, we can sense Lelaine Sedai's true opinions." Swan hesitated. Though Lelaine now played the part of Egwene's pious advocate, not too long ago she had been as displeased as everyone else over the two old novices. Few liked it when traditions changed. Now that the new novices had been entered into the novice book, it would be very difficult to put them out of the tower. But that didn't mean the Aes Sedai would continue to let older women in. Beyond that, there was a good chance that Lelaine, or whoever ended up with the Ammerlin seat, would find a way to delay or disrupt the progression of the women who had been accepted against tradition. That would certainly include Sharina. "I will let the Ammerlin know of your actions here," Swan said. "You will be rewarded."
"My reward will be Egwene Sedai's return, Swan Sedai. Pray it be swift. She entangled our fate with her own the moment she took us in. After what I've seen and what I've felt, I have no intention of stopping my training."
The woman hefted the basket.
"I assume you wish these washed and returned to you?"
"Yes, thank you."
"I am a novice, Swan Sedai. It is my duty and my pleasure."
The elderly woman bowed in respect and continued on down the path, walking with a step younger than her years. Swan watched her go, then stopped another novice. Another messenger to Bryn, just in case. "Hurry up, girl," Swan thought to Egwene, glancing toward the spire of the White Tower. "Sharina isn't the only one whose fate is entangled with yours. You've got us all wound up in that net of yours."
Chapter 19. Gambits. Chaos. The entire world was chaos. Tuan stood on the balcony of her audience hall in the palace of Ebudar, hands clasped behind her back. In the palace grounds, flagstones washed white, like so many surfaces in the city, a group of Altaran armsmen in gold and black practiced formations beneath the watchful eyes of a pair of her own officers. Beyond them, the city proper rose, white domes banded with colors spreading alongside tall white spires. Order. Here in Ebudar, there was order, even in the fields of tents and wagons outside the city. Shanshan soldiers patrolled and kept the peace. There were plans to clean out the Rahad. Just because one was poor was not a reason, or an excuse, to live without law. But this city was just a tiny, tiny pocket of order in a world of tempest. Shanshan itself was broken by civil war, now that the Empress had died. The Karen had come, but recapturing these lands of Arthur Hawkwing progressed slowly, stalled by the Dragon Reborn in the east and Damani armies in the north. She still waited to hear news of Lieutenant General Turan, but the signs were not good. Galgun maintained that they might be surprised at the outcome, but Tuan had seen a black dove the hour she was informed of Turan's predicament. The omen had been clear. He would not return alive. Chaos. She glanced to the side, where faithful Kareed stood in his thick armor, colored blood red and a deep green, nearly black. He was a tall man, square face nearly as solid as the armor he wore. He had fully 24 Death Watch guards with him this day, the day after Tuan's return to Ebudar, along with 6 Ogier gardeners, all standing along the walls. They lined the sides of the high-ceilinged, white-pillared room. Kareed sensed the chaos, and did not intend to let her be taken again. Chaos was the most deadly when you made assumptions about what it could and couldn't infect. Here in Ebudar, it manifested in the form of a faction intent on taking Tuan's own life. She had been dodging assassinations since she could walk, and she had survived them all. She anticipated them. In a way, she thrived because of them. How were you to know that you were powerful unless assassins were sent to kill you? Suroth's betrayal, however. Chaos indeed, when the leader of the Forerunners herself turned traitor. Bringing the world back into order was going to be very, very difficult. Perhaps impossible. Tuan straightened her back. She had not thought to become Empress for many years yet, but she would do her duty. She turned away from the balcony and walked back into the audience chamber to face the crowd awaiting her. Like the others of the blood, she wore ashes on her cheeks to mourn the loss of the Empress. Tuan had little affection for her mother, but affection was not needed for an Empress. She provided order and stability. Tuan had only begun to understand the importance of these things as the weight had settled on her shoulders. The chamber was wide and rectangular, lit with candelabras between the pillars and the radiant glow of sunlight through the wide balcony beyond. Tuan had ordered the room's rugs removed, preferring the bright white tiles. The ceiling bore a painted mural of fishers at sea, with gulls in the clear air, and the walls were a soft blue. A group of 10 Dakovale knelt before the candelabras to Tuan's right. They wore filmy costumes, waiting for a command. Suroth was not among them. The Death Watch guard saw to her, at least until her hair grew out. As soon as Tuan entered the room, all of the commoners bowed on knees with foreheads to the ground. Those of the blood knelt, bowing their heads. Across from the Dakovale, on the other side of the hall, Lanella and Melitene knelt in dresses emblazoned with silver lightning bolts in red panels on their skirts. Their leash Damani knelt face down. Tuan's kidnapping had been unbearable to several of the Damani. They had taken to inconsolable weeping during her absence. Her audience chair was relatively simple, a wooden seat with black velvet on the arms and back. She sat down, wearing a pleated gown of the deepest sea blue, a white cape fluttering behind her. As soon as she did, the people in the room rose from their positions of adulation, all save the Dakovale, who remained kneeling. Seleucia stood and stepped up beside the chair, her golden hair in a braid down her right side, the left side of her head shaven. She did not wear the ashes, since she was not of the blood, but the white band on her arm indicated that she, like the entire empire, mourned the loss of the Empress. Uril, Tuan's secretary and secretly her hand, stepped up to the other side of the chair. The Death Watch guards moved in subtly around her, dark armor glittering faintly in the sunlight. They had been particularly protective of her lately. She didn't blame them, recent events considered. "Here I am," Tuan thought, "surrounded by my might, Damani on one side and Death Watch guard on the other, and yet I feel no safer than I did with Matrim." How odd that she should have felt safe with him. Directly in front of her, lit by indirect sunlight from the open balcony behind, was a collection of the blood, Captain General Galgan highest of them. He wore armor this day, the breastplate painted a deep blue, nearly dark enough to be black. His powdery white hair ran in a crest, with the sides of his head shaven, and was plaited to his shoulders, for he was of the high blood. With him were two members of the low blood, Banner General Najira and Banner General Yamada, and several commoner officers. They waited patiently, carefully not meeting Tuan's eyes. A gathering of other members of the blood stood several steps behind to witness her acts. Wiry Faverda Nothish and long-faced Amenar Shumada led them. They were both important enough to be dangerous. Suroth wouldn't be the only one who saw opportunity in these times. If Tuan were to fall, practically anyone could become empress. Or emperor. The war in Shanshan would not end quickly. But when it did, the victor would undoubtedly raise him or herself to the Crystal Throne as well. And then there would be two leaders of the Shanshan Empire, divided by an ocean, united in desire to conquer one another. Neither could allow the other to live. "Order," Tuan thought, tapping the black wood of her armrest with a blue lacquered fingernail. "Order must emanate from me. I will bring the calm airs to those beset by storms." "Seleucia is my truth speaker," she announced to the room. "Let it be published among the blood." The statement was expected. Seleucia bowed her head in acceptance, though she had no desire for any appointment other than to serve and protect Tuan. She would not welcome this position. But she was also honest and straightforward. She would make an excellent truth speaker. At least this time, Tuan could be certain that her truth speaker wasn't one of the Forsaken. Did she believe Falandra's story, then? It stretched plausibility. It sounded like one of Matrim's fanciful tales of imaginary creatures that lurked in the dark.
and yet the other Suldam and Damani had corroborated Philendra's tale. Some facts, at least, seemed straightforward. Anaf had been working with Suroth. Suroth, after some persuasion, had admitted that she had met with one of the Forsaken, or at least she thought she had. She hadn't known that the Forsaken was the same as Anaf, but she seemed to find the revelation believable. Whether or not she really was Forsaken, Anaf had met with the Dragon Reborn, imitating Tuon, and had then tried to kill him. Order, Tuon thought, keeping her face still. I represent order. Tuon gestured rapidly to Seleucia, who was still Tuon's voice, and her shadow, even with the added responsibility of truth-speaker. When ordering those far beneath herself, Tuon would first pass the words to Seleucia, who would speak them. You are required to send him in, Seleucia said to Adako Vale beside the throne. He bowed himself to the ground, touching head to the floor, then hurried to the other end of the large room and opened the door. Beslan, king of Altara and high seat of House Mitzabar, was a slender youth with black eyes and hair. He had the olive skin common to the Altaran people, but had taken to wearing clothing like that favored by the blood. Loose trousers of yellow and a high-collared coat that came down only to the middle of his chest, a yellow shirt underneath. The blood had left a clear passage down the middle of the room, and Beslan walked through it, eyes lowered. Upon reaching the supplication space before the throne, he went down on his knees, then bowed low. The perfect image of a loyal subject, except for the thin golden crown on his head. Tuon gestured to Seleucia. You're bidden to rise, Seleucia said. Beslan rose, though he kept his gaze averted. He was a fine actor. The Daughter of the Nine Moons expresses her condolences to you for your loss, Seleucia said to him. I give the same to her for her loss, he said. My grief is but a candle to the great fire felt by the Shanshan people. He was too servile. He was a king. He was not required to bow himself so far. He was the equal of many of the blood. She could almost have believed he was just being submissive before the woman who would soon become empress. But she knew too much of his temperament, through both spies and hearsay. The Daughter of the Nine Moons wishes to know the reason you have ceased holding court, Seleucia said, watching Tuon's hands move. She finds it distressing that your people cannot have audience with their king. Your mother's death was as tragic as it was shocking, but your kingdom needs you. Beslan bowed. Please have her know that I did not think it appropriate to elevate myself above her. I am uncertain how to act. I meant no insult. Are you certain that is the true reason? Seleucia voiced. It is not perhaps because you are planning a rebellion against us, and do not have time for your other duties? Beslan looked up sharply, eyes wide. Your Majesty, I... You need not speak any further lies, child of Tylin, Tuon said directly to him, causing gasps of surprise from the assembled blood. I know of the things you have said to General Habiger and your friend Lord Malalin. I know of your quiet meetings in the basement of the Three Stars. I know of it all, King Beslan. The room fell silent. Beslan bowed his head for a moment. Then, surprisingly, he rose to his feet and stared her directly in the eyes. She wouldn't have thought the soft-spoken youth had it in him. I will not allow my people to... I would still my tongue if I were you, Tuon interrupted. You stand on sand as it is. Beslan hesitated. She could see the question in his eyes. Wasn't she going to execute him? If I intended to kill you, she thought, you would be dead already and you would never have seen the knife. Shan Shan is in upheaval, Tuon said, regarding him. He appeared shocked at the words. Oh, did you think I would ignore it, Beslan? I am not content to stare at the stars while my empire collapses around me. The truth must be acknowledged. My mother is dead. There is no empress.
However, the forces of the Kuren are more than sufficient to maintain our positions here on this side of the ocean, Altara included.
She leaned forward, trying to project a sense of control, of firmness. Her mother had been able to do so at all times. Tuan did not have her mother's height, but she would need that aura. Others had to feel safer, more secure, simply by entering her presence.
In times such as these, Tuan continued, threats of rebellion cannot be tolerated. Many will see opportunity in the Empire's weakness, and their divisive squabbling, if left unchecked, would prove the end of us all. Therefore I must be firm, very firm, with those who would defy me.
Then why, Beslan said, am I still alive?
You started planning your rebellion before events in the Empire were made known.
He frowned, dumbfounded.
You began your rebellion when Suroth led here, Tuan said, and when your mother was still queen. Much has changed since then, Beslan. Very much. In times like these there is potential for great accomplishment.
You must know I have no thirst for power, Beslan said. The freedom of my people is all I desire.
I do know it, Tuan said, clasping her hands before her,
lacquered nails curling, elbows on the armrests of her chair.
And that is the other reason you are still alive. You rebel not out of lust for station, but out of sheer ignorance. You are misguided, and that means you can change, should you receive the proper knowledge.
He looked at her, confused. Lower your eyes, fool. Don't make me have you strapped for insolence. As if he had heard her thoughts, he averted his eyes, then lowered them. Yes, she had judged correctly regarding this one.
How precarious her position was.
True, she had armies, but so many of them had been thrown away by Suroth's aggression.
All kingdoms on this side of the ocean would need to bow before the Crystal Throne eventually. Each Marath Damani would be leashed. Each king or queen would swear the oaths.
But Suroth had pushed too hard, particularly in the fiasco with Turon. 100,000 men lost in one battle. Madness. Tuan needed Altara. She needed Evudar. Beslan was well-loved by the people. Putting his head on a pike after the mysterious death of his mother, well, Tuan would have stability in Evudar, but she would rather not have to leave battlefronts unmanned to accomplish it.
Your mother's death is a loss, Tuan said. She was a good woman, a good queen.
Beslan's lips tightened.
You may speak, Tuan said. Her death is unexplained, he said.
The implication was obvious.
I do not know if Suroth caused her to be killed, Tuan said, softening her voice. She claims that she did not. But the matter is being investigated. If it turns out that Suroth was behind the death, you and Altara will have an apology from the throne itself.
Another gasp from the blood. She silenced them with a glance, then turned back to Beslan.
Your mother's loss is a great one. You must know that she was loyal to her oaths.
Yes, he said, voice bitter. And she gave up the throne.
No, Tuan said curtly. The throne belongs to you. This is the ignorance of which I spoke. You must lead your people. They must have a king. I have neither time nor desire to do your duty for you. You assume that the Shanshan dominance of your homeland will mean your people lack freedom. That is false. They will be more free, more protected, and more powerful when they accept our rule. I sit above you. But is this so undesirable? With the might of the Empire, you will be able to hold your borders and patrol your lands outside of Evudar. You speak of your people? Well, I have ordered something prepared for you.
She nodded to the side, where a willowy-limbed Dako Vale stepped forward with a leather satchel.
Inside, Tuan said, you will find numbers gathered by my scouts and guard forces.
You can see directly the reports of crimes during our occupation here. You will have reports and manifests comparing how the people were before the return and after it. I believe you know what you will find. The Empire is a resource to you, Beslan. A powerful, powerful ally. I will not insult you by offering you thrones you do not want. I will entice you by promising stability, food, and protection for your people. All for the simple price of your loyalty. He hesitantly accepted the satchel. I offer you a choice, Beslan, Tuan said. You may choose execution, if you wish. I will not make you Dako Vale. I will let you die with honor, and it will be published that you died because you rejected the oaths and chose not to accept the Shanshan. If you wish it, I will allow it. Your people will know that you died in defiance. Or, you may choose to serve them better. You may choose to live. If you do so, you will be raised to the High Blood. You will step forward and reign as your people need you to do. I promise you that I will not direct the affairs of your people. I will demand resources and men for my armies, as is proper, and your word cannot countermand my own. Aside from that, your power in Altara will be absolute. No blood will have the right to command, harm, or imprison your people without your permission. I will accept and review a list of noble families you feel should be raised to the low blood, and I will raise no fewer than 20 of them. Altara will become the permanent seat of the Empress on this side of the ocean. As such, it will be the most powerful kingdom here. You may choose. She leaned forward, unlacing her fingers. But understand this. If you decide to join with us, you will give me your heart, and not just your words. I will not allow you to ignore your oaths. I have given you this chance because I believe you can be a strong ally. And I think that you were misguided, perhaps by Suroth's twisted webs. You have one day to make your decision. Think well. Your mother thought this to be the best course, and she was a wise woman. The Empire means stability. A rebellion would mean only suffering, starvation, and obscurity. These are not times to be alone, Beslan. She sat back as Beslan regarded the satchel in his hands. He bowed in supplication to withdraw, though the motion was jerky, as if he were distracted. You may go, she said to him. He rose, but did not turn to leave. The room fell still as he stared down at his hands and the satchel. She could read his struggle in his expression. A Dako Vale approached to hasten him on his way, as if he had been dismissed. But Tuan raised her hand, stilling the servant. She leaned forward, several members of the Blood shuffling their feet as they waited. Beslan just stared at that satchel. Finally he looked up, eyes determined. And then, surprisingly, he got back down on his knees.
I, Beslan of House Mitzobar, pledge my fealty and service to the Daughter of the Nine Moons and through her to the Shanshan Empire, now and for all time, save that she chooses to release me of her own will. My lands and throne are hers, and I yield them to her hand. So I do swear before the light.
Tuan let herself smile. Behind Beslan, Captain General Galgan stepped forward, addressing the king.
That is not the proper way to—
Tuan silenced him with a gesture.
We demand that this people adopt our ways, General, she said. It is fitting that we accept some of theirs.
Not too many of those ways, of course. But she could thank her long conversations with Mistress Annan for allowing her to understand this. The Shanshan had perhaps made a mistake with this people in making them swear Shanshan oaths of obedience. Matrim had sworn those oaths, but ignored them handily when the time came. Yet he had been certain to keep his word to her, and his men had assured her he was a man of honor. How strange that they would be willing to elevate one oath over another. These people were odd. But she would have to understand them in order to rule them, and she would have to rule them to gather strength for her return to Shanshan.
Your oath is pleasing to me, King Beslan. I raise you to the High Blood,
and give you and your house dominance over the kingdom of Altara for now and all time. Your will for the administration and governance of it second only to that of the Imperial Throne itself. Rise.
He stood, legs looking shaky.
Are you certain you're not Taviran, my lady? He asked. Because I certainly wasn't expecting to do that when I walked in here.
Taviran. These people and their foolish superstitions.
I am pleased with you, she said to him. I knew your mother for only a short time, but I did find her quite capable. I would not have enjoyed being forced to execute her only remaining son.
He nodded in appreciation. To the side, Seleucia covertly signed, That was well handled, unconventional perhaps, but very delicately done. Tuan felt a warm sense of pride. She turned to the white-haired General Galgan.
General, I realize you have been waiting to speak with me, and your patience is to be commended. You may now speak your thoughts. King Beslan, you may withdraw or remain. It is your right to attend any public conferences I have in your kingdom, and you need no permission or invitation to attend.
Beslan nodded, bowing but retreating to the side of the room to watch.
Thank you, highest daughter, Galgan said reverently, stepping forward.
He waved to his sojin, who stood in the hallway outside. They entered, first prostrating themselves before Tuan, then quickly set up a table and several maps. One servant brought Galgan a bundle, which he carried, approaching Tuan. Kareed was at her right shoulder in a moment, Seleucia at her left, but Galgan kept a respectful distance. He bowed and unrolled the item on the ground. It was a banner of red, bearing a circle in the center, split by a sinuous line. One half of the circle was black, the other white.
What is it?
Tuan asked, leaning forward.
The banner of the Dragon Reborn, Galgan said. He sent it with a messenger, asking yet again for a meeting.
He glanced up, not meeting her eyes, but showing a thoughtful, concerned face.
This morning when I arose, Tuan said, I saw a pattern like three towers in the sky and a hawk high in the air passing between them.
The various members of the blood in the room nodded appreciatively. Only Beslan seemed confused. How did these people live, not knowing the omens? Had they no desire to understand the visions of fate the pattern was giving them? The hawk and three towers were an omen of difficult choices to come. They indicated that boldness would be needed.
What are your thoughts on the Dragon Reborn's request for a meeting?
Tuan asked Galgan.
Perhaps it would be unwise to meet with this man, highest daughter. I am not certain of his claims to his title. Beyond this question, does the Empire not have other concerns at this time?
You wonder why our forces have not retreated, Tuan said. Why we have not struck out for Shanshan to secure the throne.
He bowed his head.
I trust your wisdom, highest daughter.
This is the Dragon Reborn, Tuan said. And not just an impostor. I am convinced of it. He must bow before the Crystal Throne before the last battle can begin. And so we must stay. It is not an accident that the return happened now. We are needed here. More than we are needed, unfortunately, in our homeland.
Galgan nodded slowly. He agreed with her on not retreating to Shanshan. He had simply assumed it would be what she wished. In declaring they would stay, she had earned his respect. Not that he wouldn't still consider seizing the throne for himself. A man could not hold his position without a great deal of ambition. However, he was known to be a prudent man as well as an ambitious one. He would not strike, unless he was convinced it was for the best. He would have to believe that he had a strong potential for success, and that removing Tuan would be better for the Empire. That was the difference between an ambitious fool and an ambitious wise man. The latter understood that killing someone was only the beginning. Taking Tuan's life and assuming the throne himself would gain him nothing if it alienated the rest of the blood.
He walked to his table with maps.
If you wish to continue to prosecute the war, Highest Daughter, permit me to explain the condition of your army. One of our most ambitious plans is being organized by Lieutenant General Yulun.
Galgun gestured to the assembled officers, and a short, dark-skinned man of the low blood stepped forward. He wore a black wig to hide his baldness, and he approached and knelt before Tuan, bowing.
"You are commanded to rise and speak, General," Seleucia voiced.
"The Highest Daughter should know my thanks," Yulun said, rising.
At the map table he gestured for several aides to hold up a map so that Tuan could see.
"Aside from setbacks in Arid Doman, the process of reclaiming these lands has proceeded as expected. More slowly than we would wish, but not without great victories. The people of these kingdoms do not rally to the defense of their neighboring nations. We have had great success seizing them one at a time. Only two issues cause us worry. The first is this Randall Thor, the Dragon Reborn, who has been pursuing an aggressive war of unification to the north and east. The Highest Daughter's wisdom will be needed in teaching us to subdue him. The other concern has been the large number of Marath Damani concentrated in the place known as Tarvalan. I believe the Highest Daughter has heard of the great weapon they used to destroy a large patch of land north of Ebudar."
Tuan nodded.
"The Suldam have never seen its like," Yulun continued. "We assume it is a thing of Damani which can be taught to them, if the right Marath Damani are taken. This wondrous ability they have to transport instantly from one place to another, if true, will prove a second technique of great tactical advantage that we must capture."
Tuan nodded again, studying the map, which showed the place called Tarvalan. Seleucia voiced,
"The Highest Daughter is curious as to your plans. You will proceed."
"My thanks are expressed deeply," Yulun said, bowing. "As Captain of the Air, I have the honor of commanding the Rakan and Torakan serving the return. I believe that a strike at the very heart of our enemy's lands would not only be possible but highly advantageous. We have not yet had to fight many of these Marath Damani in combat, but as we advance into lands controlled by the Dragon Reborn, we will undoubtedly face them in great numbers. They assume that they are safe from us at this time. A strike now could have great impact on the future. Each Marath Damani we leash is not only a powerful tool gained by our forces, but one lost by the enemy. Preliminary reports claim that there are hundreds upon hundreds of Marath Damani congregated in this place called the White Tower."
That many? Tuan thought. A force like that could turn the war entirely. True, those Marath Damani who had traveled with Matrim had said that they would not take part in wars. Indeed, Marath Damani who had once been Aes Sedai had, so far, proven useless as weapons. But could there be some way to twist their supposed vows? Something Matrim had said in passing made her suspect they could. Her fingers flew.
"The Daughter of the Nine Moons wonders how a strike against them could be feasible," Seleucia voiced. "The distance is great. Hundreds of leagues."
"We would use a force of mostly Torakan," General Yulun said, "with some Rakan for scouting. Our captured maps show large grasslands with very few inhabitants, which could be used as resting points along the way. We could strike across Murundi here,"
he pointed at a second map which aides held up,
"and come at Tarvalan from the south. If it pleases the Highest Daughter, we could raid at night, while the Marath Damani are asleep. Our objective would be to capture as many of them as possible."
"It is wondered if this really could be accomplished," Seleucia voiced.
Tuan was intrigued.
"What numbers would we be able to use for such a raid?"
"If we were fully committed," Yulun asked, "I believe I could gather up between 80 and 100 Torakan for the assault."
80 to 100 Torakan. So, perhaps around 300 soldiers with equipment, leaving room to bring back captured Marath Damani. 300 would be a considerable force for a raid like this, but they would have to move quickly and lightly, so as to not be trapped.
"If it pleases the Highest Daughter," General Galgun said, stepping forward again. "I believe General Yulin's plan has much merit. It is not without potential for great loss, but we will never have another such opportunity. If brought to bear in our conflict, those Marath Damani could disable us. And if we could gain access to this weapon of theirs, or even their ability to travel great distances, well, I believe that the risk of every Tohrakan in our army is worth the gains. If it pleases the Highest Daughter," General Yulin continued, "our plan calls for the use of 20 squads of the Fist of Heaven, 200 troops total, and 50 linked Suldam. We think that perhaps a small group of blood knives would be appropriate as well."
Blood knives? The most elite members of the Fist of Heaven, itself an exclusive group. Yulin and Galgun were dedicated to this action. One never committed blood knives unless one was very serious, for they did not return from their missions. Their duty was to stay behind after the fists withdrew and cause damage, as much damage as possible to the enemy. If they could place some of them in Tarvalin with orders to kill as many Marath Damani as possible.
"The Dragon Reborn will not react well to this raid," Tuan said to Galgun. "Is he not connected to these Marath Damani?"
"By some reports," Galgun said. "Others say he is opposed to them. Still others say they are his pawns. Our poor intelligence in this area lowers my eyes, Highest Daughter. I have not been able to sort the lies from the truths. Until we have better information, we must assume the worst, that this raid will anger him greatly."
"And you still think it worthwhile?"
"Yes," Galgun said without hesitation. "If these Marath Damani are connected to the Dragon Reborn, then we have greater reason to strike now, before he can use them against us. Perhaps the raid will enrage him, but it will also weaken him, which will place you in a better position for negotiating with him."
Tuan nodded thoughtfully. Undoubtedly that was the difficult decision of the omen, but her choice seemed very obvious. Not a difficult decision at all. All of the Marath Damani in Tarvalin must be collared, and this was an excellent way to weaken resistance to the ever-victorious army with a single powerful blow. But the omen spoke of a difficult decision. She gestured to Seleucia.
"Are there any in the room who disapprove of this plan?" the voice asked. "Any who would offer objection to what General Yulin and his men have advanced?"
The blood in the room regarded one another. Beslin might have stirred, but he remained silent. The Altarans had not made any objections to their Marath Damani being collared. It seemed they had little trust for those who could channel. They had not been as prudent as Amadisia in outlawing these Aes Sedai, but neither were they welcoming. Beslin would not object to a strike against the White Tower. She sat back, waiting. For what? Perhaps this wasn't the decision the omen had referred to. She opened her mouth to give the order to go forward with the raid, but at that moment the opening of the doors made her pause. The Death Watch guards who guarded the door stepped aside a moment later, admitting a Sojin who served in the hallway. The strong-armed man, Makom, bowed himself low to the ground, the black braid over his right shoulder dropping to the side and hitting the tiled floor.
"May it please the Daughter of the Nine Moons, Lieutenant General Tylee Kirgun would like an audience."
Galgun looked shocked.
"What is it?" Tuan asked him.
"I had not realized that she had returned, Highest Daughter," he said. "I suggest in humility that she be given leave to speak. She is one of my finest officers."
"She may enter," Seleucia voiced.
A male Dakovale in a white robe entered, preceding a woman in armor, her helm under her arm. Dark of skin, with short black hair worn in tight curls against her scalp, she was tall and lean. Her hair was sprinkled with white at the temples. The overlapping plates of her armor were striped with red, yellow, and blue lacquer, and creaked as she walked. She was only of the low blood, recently raised by General Galgun's order,
but she had been informed of this via Rakan. She wore her hair barely shaved a finger's width up the sides of her head. Tylee's eyes were red with fatigue. Judging by the scent of sweat and the stink of horse she gave off, she had come straight to Tuon upon arriving in the city. She was followed into the room by several younger soldiers, also exhausted, one bearing a large brown sack. Upon reaching the supplication space, a red square of cloth, all went down on their knees. The common soldiers proceeded to touch foreheads to the floor, and Tylee jerked as if to follow, but stopped herself. She was not yet accustomed to being one of the blood.
"It is obvious that you are tired, warrior," Seleucia voiced.
Tuon leaned forward.
"It is presumed that you have news of great import?"
Tylee rose to one knee, then gestured to the side. The soldier rose to his knees and lifted up his brown sack. It was stained on the bottom with a dark, crusted liquid. Blood.
"If it pleases the highest daughter,"
Tylee said, voice betraying exhaustion. She nodded to her man and he opened his sack, dumping things onto the floor. The heads of several animals. A boar, a wolf, and... a hawk? Tuon felt a chill. That hawk's head was as large as a person's, perhaps larger. But they were not. Right. The heads were horribly deformed. She could swear that the hawk's head, which rolled so that she could see the face clearly, had human eyes, and... the other heads had human features as well. Tuon suppressed a shiver. What foul omen was this?
What is the meaning of this? Galgun demanded.
I presume that the highest daughter knows of my military venture against the Aiel,
Tylee said, still on one knee. Tylee had captured Damani during that engagement, though Tuon didn't know much more than that. General Galgun had been awaiting her return with some curiosity to receive the full story.
In my venture, Tylee continued, I was joined by men of various nationalities, none of whom had sworn the oaths. I will give a full report on them when there is time.
She hesitated, then glanced at the heads.
These creatures attacked my company during our return ride, 10 leagues from Ebu Dar. We took heavy casualties. We brought several full bodies as well as these heads. They walked on 2 feet like men, but had much the appearance of animals.
She hesitated again.
I believe them to be what some on this side of the ocean speak of as Trollocs. I believe them to be coming here.
Chaos. The blood began to argue about the implausibility of it. General Galgun immediately ordered his officers to organize patrols and send runners to warn of a potential attack on the city. The Suldam at the side of the room hurried forward to inspect the heads, while the Death Watch guards quietly surrounded Tuon to give an extra layer of defense, watching everyone, blood, servants, and soldiers, with equal care. Tuon felt she should be shocked, but oddly she wasn't.
So Matrim was not mistaken about this, she signed covertly to Seleucia.
And she had assumed Trollocs to be nothing more than superstition. She glanced at the heads again. Revolting. Seleucia seemed troubled.
Are there other things he said that we discounted, I wonder?
Tuon hesitated.
We shall have to ask him. I should very much like to have him back.
She froze. She hadn't meant to admit so much. She found her own emotions curious, however. She had felt safe with him, ridiculous though it seemed, and she wished he were with her now. These heads were yet another proof that she knew very little of him. She reasserted control of the chattering crowd. Seleucia voiced,
"You will silence yourselves."
The room fell still, though the blood and the Suldam still looked very disturbed. Tylee still knelt, head bowed, the soldier who had borne the heads kneeling beside her. Yes, she would have to be thoroughly questioned.
"This news changes little," Seleucia voiced. "We were already aware that the last battle approaches. We appreciate Lieutenant General Tylee's revelations. She is to be commended. But this only makes it more urgent that we subdue the Dragon Reborn."
There were several nods from those in the room, including General Galgun. Beslan did not seem so quickly persuaded. He just looked troubled.
"If it pleases the Highest Daughter," Tylee said, bowing. "You are allowed to speak. These last few weeks, I have seen many things that have given me thought," Tylee said. "Even before my troops were attacked, I was worried. The wisdom and grace of the Highest Order undoubtedly let her see further than one such as I. But I believe that our conquests so far in this land have been easy compared to what might come. If I may be so bold, I believe that the Dragon Reborn and those associated with him may make better allies than enemies."
It was a bold statement. Tuon leaned forward, lacquered nails clicking on the armrests of her chair. Many of the low blood would be so in awe at meeting one of the Empress's household, much less the Highest Daughter, that they would not dare speak. Yet this woman offered suggestions? In direct opposition to Tuon's published will?
"A difficult decision is not always a decision where both sides are equally matched, Tuon," Seleucia said suddenly. "Perhaps in this case a difficult decision is one that is right, but requires an implication of fault as well."
Tuon blinked in surprise. "Yes," she realized. "Seleucia is my truth speaker now. It would take time to accustom herself to the woman in that role. It had been years since Seleucia had corrected or reproved her in public. And yet, meeting with the Dragon Reborn in person? She did need to contact him, and had planned to. But would it not be better to go to him in strength, his armies defeated, the White Tower torn down? She needed him brought to the Crystal Throne under very controlled circumstances, with the understanding that he was to submit to her authority. And yet, with Shan Shan in rebellion, with her position here in Altara barely stabilized, well, perhaps some time to think. Some time to take a few deep breaths and secure what she already had would be worth delaying her strike on the White Tower.
General Galgun, send Rakan to our forces in Almuth Plain and Eastern Altara, she said firmly. Tell them to hold our interests but avoid confrontation with the Dragon Reborn, and reply to his request for a meeting. The Daughter of the Nine Moons will meet with him.
General Galgun nodded, bowing. Order must be brought to the world. If she had to do that by lowering her eyes slightly and meeting with the Dragon Reborn, then so be it. Oddly, she felt herself wishing, once again, that Matrim were still with her. She could have put his knowledge of this Randall Thor to good use in preparing for the meeting.
Stay well, you curious man, she thought,
glancing back at the balcony, northward.
Do not dig yourself into trouble deeper than you can climb to freedom. You are Prince of the Ravens now. Remember to act appropriately, wherever it is you are.
Chapter 20 On a Broken Road. Women, Matt declared as he rode Pips down the dusty, little-used road, are like mules. He frowned. Wait. No. Goats. Women are like goats. Except every flaming one thinks she's a horse instead and a prized racing mare to boot. Do you understand me, Telmanis?
Pure poetry, Matt, Telmanis said, tamping the tobacco down into his pipe.
Matt flicked his reins, Pips continuing to plod along. Tall three-needle pines lined the sides of the stone roadway. They'd been lucky to find this ancient road, which must have been made before the breaking. It was mostly overgrown, the stones shattered in many places, large sections of the roadway just, well, just gone. Sapling pines had begun to sprout at the sides of the roadway and between rocks, miniature versions of their towering fathers above. The path was wide, if very rough, which was good. Matt had 7,000 men with him, all mounted, and they'd been riding hard in the little under a week they'd spent traveling since sending Tuon back to Abu Dhar. Reasoning with a woman is impossible, Matt continued, eyes forward. It's like, well, reasoning with a woman is like sitting down to a friendly game of dice. Only the woman refuses to acknowledge the basic bloody rules of the game.
A man. He'll cheat you, but he'll do it honestly. He'll use loaded dice so that you think you're losing by chance. And if you aren't clever enough to spot what he's doing, then maybe he deserves to take your coin. And that's that. A woman, though. She'll sit down to that same game, and she'll smile and act like she's going to play. Only when it's her turn to throw, she'll toss a pair of her own dice that are blank on all six sides. Not a single pip showing. She'll inspect her throw, then she'll look up at you and say, "Clearly, I just won." Now you'll scratch your head and look at the dice. Then you'll look up at her, then down at the dice again. "But there aren't any pips on these dice," you'll say. "Yes, there are," she'll say. "And both dice rolled a one." "That's exactly the number you need to win," you'll say. "What a coincidence," she'll reply, then begin to scoop up your coins. And you'll sit there trying to wrap your head about what just happened, and you realize something. A pair of ones isn't the winning throw. Not when you threw a six on your turn. That means she needed a pair of twos instead. Excitedly, you'll explain what you've discovered. Only then, do you know what she'll do?
"No idea, Matt," Telmanis replied, chewing on his pipe, a thin wisp of smoke curling out of the bowl.
"Then she'll reach over," Matt said, "and rub the blank faces of her dice, and then, with a perfectly straight face, she'll say, 'I'm sorry. There was a spot of dirt on the dice. Clearly you can see that they actually came up as twos.' And she'll believe it. She'll bloody believe it."
"Incredible," Telmanis said.
"Only that's not the end of it."
"I had presumed that it wouldn't be, Matt."
"She scoops up all of your coins," Matt said, gesturing with one hand, the other steadying his Ashandarai across his saddle. "And then every other woman in the room will come over and congratulate her on throwing that pair of twos. The more you complain, the more of those bloody women will join the argument. You'll be outnumbered in a moment, and each of those women will explain to you how those dice clearly read twos, and how you really need to stop behaving like a child. Every single flaming one of them will see the twos. Even the prudish woman who has hated your woman from birth, since your woman's granny stole the other woman's granny's honey cake recipe when they were both maids. That woman will side against you."
"They are nefarious creatures indeed," Telmanis said, voice flat and even. Telmanis rarely smiled.
"By the time they're done," Matt continued, almost more to himself, "you'll be left with no coin, several lists worth of errands to run, and what clothing to wear, and a splitting headache. You'll sit there and stare at the table and begin to wonder, just maybe, if those dice didn't read twos after all. If only to preserve what's left of your sanity. That's what it's like to reason with a woman, I tell you."
"And you did so. At length."
"You aren't making sport of me, are you?"
"Why, Matt," the Kyrianan said. "You know I'd never do such a thing."
"Too bad," Matt muttered, glancing at him suspiciously. "I could use a laugh." He looked over his shoulder.
"Bannon! Where on the Dark One's blistered backside are we?"
The fat former horse thief looked up. He rode a short distance behind Matt, and he carried a map of the area, unrolled and folded across a board so he could read it in the saddle. He'd been poring over the bloody thing the better half of the morning. Matt had asked him to get them through Murundi quietly, not get them lost in the mountains for months.
"That's Blinder's Peak," Bannon said, gesturing with a pudgy finger toward a flat-topped mountain just barely visible over the tips of the pines. "At least I think it is. It might be Mount Sardlin."
The squat hill didn't look like much of a mountain. It barely had any snow atop it. Of course, few mountains in this area were impressive, not compared to the mountains of mist back near the two rivers. Here, northeast of the Demona Range, the landscape fell into a grouping of low foothills. It was difficult terrain, but navigable, if one were determined. And Matt was determined. Determined not to be pinned in by the Seanchan again, determined not to be seen by any who didn't have to know he was there. He'd paid the butcher too much so far. He wanted out of this hangman's noose of a country.
"Well," Matt said, reining Pips back to ride beside Bannon, "which of those mountains is it? Maybe we should go ask Master Roy Dell again."
The map belonged to the master mapmaker. It was only because of his presence that they'd been able to find this roadway in the first place. But Bannon insisted on being the one to guide the troop. A mapmaker wasn't the same thing as a scout. You didn't have a dusty cartographer ride out and lead the way for you, Bannon insisted. In truth, Master Roydell didn't have a lot of experience being a guide. He was a scholar, an academic. He could explain a map for you perfectly, but he had as much trouble as Bannon making sense of where they were, since this roadway was so disjointed and broken, the pines high enough to obscure landmarks, the hilltops all nearly identical. Of course, there was also the fact that Bannon seemed threatened by the presence of the mapmaker, as if he were worried about being unseated from his position guiding Matt and the band. Matt had never expected such an emotion from the overweight horse thief. It might have been enough to make him amused if they weren't lost so much of the flaming time. Bannon scowled. I think that has to be Mount Sardlin. Yes, it's gotta be. Which means we keep heading along the roadway, Bannon said. The same thing I told you an hour ago. We can't bloody march an army through a forest this thick now, can we? That means staying on the stones.
I'm just asking, Matt said, pulling down the brim of his hat against the sun. A commander's got to ask things like this.
I should ride ahead, Bannon said, scowling again. He was fond of scowls. If that is Mount Sardlin, then there should be a village of fair size an hour or two further along. I might be able to spot it from the next rise. Go then, Matt said. They had advance scouts out, of course, but none of them were as good as Bannon. Despite his size, the man could sneak close enough to an enemy fortification to count the whiskers in the camp guards' beards and never be seen. He'd probably make off with their stew, too. Bannon shook his head as he regarded the map again. Actually, he muttered, now that I think about it, maybe that's Favlin Mountain. He set off at a trot before Matt could object. Matt sighed, healing Pips to catch up to Telmanis. The Kyrianan shook his head. He could be an intense one, Telmanis. Early in their association, Matt had assumed him to be stern, unable to have fun. He was learning better. Telmanis wasn't stern, he was just reserved. But at times there seemed to be a twinkle in the nobleman's eyes, as if he were laughing at the world, despite that set jaw and his unsmiling lips. Today he wore a red coat trimmed with gold, and his forehead was shaved and powdered after Kyrian fashion. It looked bloody ridiculous, but who was Matt to judge? Telmanis might have terrible fashion sense, but he was a loyal officer and a good man. Besides, he had excellent taste in wine.
Don't look so glum, Matt, Telmanis said, puffing on his gold-rimmed pipe.
Where'd he gotten that, anyway? Matt didn't remember him having it before.
Your men have full bellies, full pockets, and they just won a great victory. Not much more than that a soldier can ask for.
We buried 1,000 men, Matt said. That's no victory. The memories in his head, the ones that weren't his, said he should be proud. The battle had gone well. But there were still those dead who had depended on him.
There are always losses, Telmanis said. You can't let them eat you up, Matt. It happens.
There aren't losses when you don't fight in the first place.
Then why ride to battle so often?
I only fight when I can't avoid it, Matt snapped. Blood and bloody ashes, he only fought when he had to. When they trapped him. Why did that seem to happen every time he turned around?
Whatever you say, Matt,
Telmanis said, taking out his pipe and pointing it at Matt knowingly.
But something's got you on edge, and it isn't the men we lost.
Flaming noblemen, even the ones you could stand like Telmanis always thought they knew so much. Of course, Matt was now a nobleman himself. Don't think about that, he told himself. Telmanis had spent a few days calling Matt Your Highness until Matt had lost his temper and yelled at the man. Kyrianan could be such sticklers for rank. When Matt had first realized what his marriage to Tuon meant, he'd laughed, but it had been the laughter of incredulous pain. And men called him lucky. Well, why couldn't his luck have helped him avoid this fate? Bloody Prince of the Ravens? What did that mean? Well, right now he had to worry about his men. He glanced over his shoulder, looking along the ranks of cavalrymen, with crossbowmen riding behind. There were thousands of both, though Matt had ordered their banners stowed.
They weren't likely to pass many travelers on this backwater path, but if anyone did see them, he didn't want their tongues wagging. Would the Shonchan chase him? He and Tuan both knew they were on opposing sides now, and she'd seen what his army could do. Did she love him? He was married to her, but Shonchan didn't think like regular people. She'd stayed in his possession, enduring captivity, never running. But he had little doubt that she'd move against him if she thought it best for her empire. Yes, she'd send men after him, though potential pursuit didn't trouble him half as much as the worry that she might not make it back to Ebu Dar safely. Someone had offered a very large pile of coin for Tuan's head. That Shonchan traitor, the leader of the army Matt had destroyed. Had he been working alone? Were there others? What had Matt released Tuan into? The questions haunted him. Should I have let her go, do you think? Matt found himself asking. Talmanis shrugged.
You gave your word, Matt, and I think that rather large Shonchan fellow with the determined eyes and the black armor wouldn't have reacted well if you'd tried to keep her.
She could still be in danger, Matt said, almost to himself, still looking backward. I shouldn't have let her out of my sight, fool woman.
Matt, Talmanis said, pointing at him with the pipe again. I'm surprised at you. Why, you're starting to sound downright husbandly.
That gave Matt a start. He twisted around in Pip's saddle. What was that? What does that mean?
Nothing, Matt, Talmanis said hurriedly. Just that, the way you're mooning after her,
I am not mooning, Matt snapped, pulling the lip of his hat down, then adjusting his scarf. His medallion was a comfortable weight around his neck. I'm just worried, that's all. She knows a lot about the band, and she could give away our strengths.
Talmanis shrugged, puffing his pipe. They rode for a time in silence. The pine needles soughed in the wind, and Matt occasionally heard women's laughter from behind, where the Aes Sedai rode in a little cluster. For all the fact that they didn't like one another, they usually got along just fine when others could see them. But, as he'd said to Talmanis, women were only enemies with one another as long as there wasn't a man around to gang up on.
The sun was marked by a blazing patch of clouds. Matt hadn't seen pure sunlight in days. He hadn't seen Tuan in as long either. The two events seemed paired in his head. Was there a connection?
Bloody fool, he thought to himself.
Next you'll start thinking like her, reading portents into every little thing, looking for symbols and meaning every time a rabbit runs across your path or a horse lets wind. That kind of fortune-telling was all nonsense. Though he had to admit, he now cringed every time he heard an owl hoot twice. Have you ever loved a woman, Talmanis? Matt found himself asking.
Several, the short man replied, riding with pipe smoke curling behind him.
Ever consider marrying one of them?
No, thank the light, Talmanis said.
Then, apparently, he thought better of what he'd just said.
I mean, it wasn't right for me at the time, Matt. But I'm certain it will work out fine for you.
Matt scowled. If Tuan was going to bloody finally decide to go through with the marriage, couldn't she have picked a time when others couldn't hear?
But no! She'd gone and spoken in front of everyone, including the Aes Sedai.
That meant Matt had been doomed. Aes Sedai were great at keeping secrets unless those secrets could in any way embarrass or inconvenience Matrim Cawthon. Then you could be certain the news would be spread through the entire camp in a day's time and likely be known 3 villages down the road as well. His own bloody mother, leagues and leagues away, had probably heard the news by now.
I'm not giving up gambling, Matt muttered, or drinking. So I believe you've told me, Talmanis said. 3 or 4 times so far. I half believe that if I were to peek into your tent at night, I'd find you mumbling it in your sleep. I'm going to keep bloody gambling and drinking. Where's my bloody drink? Anyone want to gamble for it?
He said it with a perfectly straight face, but once again there was that hint of a smile in his eyes, if you knew just where to look.
I just want to make sure everyone knows, Matt said. I don't want anyone to start thinking I'm getting soft just because of, you know.
Talmanis shot him a consoling look.
You won't go soft just because you got married, Matt.
Why, some of the great captains themselves are married, I believe. Davram Bashir is for certain, and Rodol Iturralda. No, you won't go soft because you're married. Matt nodded sharply. Good. That was settled. You might go boring, though, Telmanis noted. All right, that's it, Matt declared. Next village we find, we're going to go dicing at the tavern. You and me. Telmanis grimaced. With the kind of third-rate wine these little mountain villages have? Please, Matt. Next you'll be wanting me to drink ale. No arguing. Matt glanced over his shoulder as he heard familiar voices. Olvar, ears sticking out to the sides, diminutive face as ugly as any Matt had seen, sat astride Wind, chatting with Noel, who rode beside him on a bony gelding. The gnarled old man was nodding appreciatively to what Olvar was saying. The little boy looked astonishingly solemn, and was undoubtedly explaining yet another of his theories on how to best sneak into the Tower of Genji. "Who now?" Telmanis said. "There's Vanin." Matt turned to spot a rider approaching along the rocky path ahead. Vanin always looked so ridiculous, perched like a melon atop the back of his horse, his feet sticking out to the sides. But the man could ride, there was no doubting that. "It is Mount Sardlun," Vanin proclaimed as he rode up to them, wiping his sweaty, balding brow. "The village is just ahead. It's called Hinderstap on the map. These are bloody good maps," he added grudgingly. Matt exhaled in relief. He'd begun to think that they might end up wandering these mountains until the last battle came and went. "Great," he began. "We can..." "A village?" a curt female voice demanded. Matt turned with a sigh as three riders forced their way up to the front of the column. Telmanis reluctantly raised a hand to the soldiers behind, halting the march as the Aes Sedai descended on poor Vanin. The rotund man squatted down in his saddle, looking for all the world as though he'd rather have been discovered stealing horses, and therefore on his way to execution, than have to sit there and be interrogated by Aes Sedai. Jolene led the pack. Once, Matt might have described her as a pretty girl, with her slender figure and large, inviting brown eyes. But that ageless Aes Sedai face was an instant warning for him now. No, he wouldn't dare think of the green as pretty now. Begin letting yourself think of Aes Sedai as pretty, and in two clicks of the tongue you'd find yourself wrapped around her finger and hopping at her command. Why, Jolene had already hinted that she'd like to have Matt as a warder. Was she still sore at him because he'd paddled her? She couldn't hurt him with the power, of course, even without his medallion, since Aes Sedai were sworn not to use the power to kill except in very specific instances. But he was no fool. He'd noticed that those oaths of theirs didn't say anything about using knives. The two with Jolene were Edesina of the Yellow Aja and Teslin of the Red. Edesina was pleasant enough to look at, save for that ageless face, but Teslin was about as appetizing as a stick. Sharp of face, the Ilianar woman was bony and scrappy, like an aged cat left too long on its own. But she seemed to have a good head on her shoulders from what Matt had seen, and he'd found her treating him with some measure of respect sometimes. Respect from a Red? Imagine that. Still, from the way each of those Aes Sedai looked at Matt in turn as they reached the front of the line, you'd never know that they owed him their lives. That was the way of it with women. Save her life and she'd inevitably claim that she'd been about to escape on her own, and therefore owed you nothing. Half the time she'd berate you for messing up her supposed plans. Why did he bother? One of these days, burn him, he was going to get smart and leave the next lot crying in their chains. "What was this?" Jolene demanded of Vanin. "You've finally determined where we are?" "Bloody well have," Vanin said, then unabashedly scratched himself. "Good man, Vanin," Matt smiled. "Treated all people the same, Vanin did. Aes Sedai and all." Jolene stared Vanin straight in the eyes, looming like a gargoyle atop some lord's mansion stonework. Vanin actually cringed, then wilted, then finally looked downward, abashed.
"I mean, I have indeed, Jolene Sedai."
Matt felt his smile fade.
"Burn it all, Vanin."
"Excellent," Jolene said. "And there is a village ahead, I heard? Finally, perhaps, we'll find a decent inn. I could use something other than the fare these ruffians of Cawthon's call food." Here now, Matt said. That isn't...
How far do we be from Camelin, Master Cawthon? Teslin cut in. She did her best to ignore Jolene. The two of them seemed at one another's throats lately, in the most cool-faced and outwardly amiable of ways, of course. Aes Sedai didn't squabble. He'd gotten a talking to once for calling their discussions squabbles. Never mind that Matt had sisters and knew what a good squabble sounded like.
What did you say earlier, Vannon? Matt asked, looking at him. That we're about 200 leagues from Camelin?
Vannon nodded. The plan was to head for Camelin first, as he needed to meet up with Estion and Darid and secure needed information and supplies. After that, he could make good on his promise to Tom. The Tower of Genji would have to wait a few more weeks.
200 leagues, Teslin said. How long until we arrive, then?
Well, I guess that depends, Vannon said. I could probably make 200 leagues in a little over a week if I were going alone with a couple of good horses to ride in shifts and was crossing familiar terrain. The whole army, though? Through these hills using a broken roadway? 20 days, I'd say. Maybe longer.
Jolene glanced at Matt.
We aren't leaving the band behind, Matt said. Not an option, Jolene.
She looked away, her expression dissatisfied.
You're welcome to go on your own, Matt said. That goes for each of you. You, Aes Sedai, aren't my prisoners. Leave any time you want, so long as you head north. I won't risk you heading back to be taken by Shan Chan.
What would it be like, traveling with just the band again, not an Aes Sedai in sight?
Ah, if only.
Teslin looked thoughtful. Jolene glanced at her, but the red didn't give any indication if she'd be willing to leave or not. Edesina, however, hesitated, then nodded to Jolene. She was willing.
Very well, Jolene said to Matt with a haughty air. It would be good to be away from your crudeness, Cawthon. Prepare for us, say, 20 mounts, and we shall be off.
20?
Matt asked.
Yes, Jolene said. Your man here mentioned that he'd need 2 horses to make the trip in a reasonable amount of time, so that he could remount, presumably, when one of the beasts grew tired.
I count 2 of you, Matt said, his anger rising. That means 4 horses. I figured you'd be smart enough to do that math, Jolene.
And then, softer, he added, if just barely. Jolene's eyes opened wide, and Edesina's expression was painted with shock. Teslin gave him a shocked glance, seeming disappointed. To the side, Telmanis just lowered his pipe and whistled quietly.
That medallion of yours makes you impudent, Matrim Cawthon, Jolene said coldly.
My mouth makes me impudent, Jolene, Matt replied with a sigh, fingering the medallion hidden beneath his loosely tied shirt. The medallion just makes me truthful. I believe you were going to explain why you need to take 20 of my horses, when I barely have enough for my men as it is.
2 each for Edesina and myself, Jolene said stiffly. 2 each for the former Suldam. You don't presume that I'm going to leave them behind to be corrupted by your little band here.
2 Suldam, Matt said, ignoring the barb. That's 8 horses.
2 for Satala. I assume she'll want to be away from all of this with us.
10.
2 more for Teslin, Jolene said. She will undoubtedly want to go with us, though she currently has nothing to say on the matter. And we'll need about 4 pack animals worth to carry our things. They'll have to trade their burdens too, so 4 more for that. 20.
Which you'll feed how? Matt asked. If you're riding that hard, you won't have time to graze your horses. There's barely anything for them to eat these days anyway.
That had proven a big problem. The spring grass wasn't coming in. The meadows they passed were brown with fallen leaves, the dead winter weeds pressed flat by snow, barely a new shoot of grass or weed. Horses could feed on the dead leaves and winter grass, of course, but wild deer and other animals had been active, eating down whatever they could find. If the land didn't decide to start blooming soon, well, they were in for a difficult summer. But that was another problem entirely.
We will need you to give us feed, of course, Jolene said. And some coin for inns.
And who is going to take care of all those horses? You're going to brush them down each night, check their hooves, see that their feed is properly measured?
I suppose we should take a handful of your soldiers with us, Jolene said, sounding dissatisfied. a necessary inconvenience. The only thing that is necessary, Matt said flatly, is for my men to stay where they're wanted, not where they're an inconvenience. No, they stay, and you'll have no coin from me. If you want to go, you can take one horse each and a single pack horse to carry your things. I'll give you some feed for the poor beasts, and giving you that much is generous. But with only one horse each, we'll barely be faster than the army, Jolene said. Imagine that, Matt said. He turned away from her. Bannon, go and tell Mandevwin to pass the word. We'll be camping soon. I know it's barely afternoon, but I want the band far enough from that village not to be threatening, but close enough that a few of us can go down to feel things out. All right, Bannon said, with none of the respect he'd shown the bloody Aes Sedai. He turned his horse and began to ride down the line. And Bannon, Matt called, make sure Mandevwin is aware that when I say a few of us will go down, I mean a very small group, led by myself and Talmanis. I won't have that village invaded by 7,000 soldiers looking for fun. I'll buy a cart in the town and what ale I can find, then send it back for the men. There is to be strict order in camp, with no one accidentally wandering down to visit now. Understand? Bannon nodded, looking grim. It was never fun to be the one who had to inform the men that they weren't going to be getting leave. Matt turned back to the Aes Sedai. Well, he asked, you taking my kind offer or not? Jolene just sniffed, then trotted her horse back down the ranks, obviously turning down the chance to go alone. Pity that. It would have made him smile each step of the way to think of it, though it probably would have taken Jolene all of 3 days to find some sap in a village somewhere to give her his horses so that her crew could ride faster. Edesina rode away and Teslin trailed after, regarding Matt with a curious expression. She still looked disappointed in him, too. He glanced away, then felt annoyed at himself. What did he care what she thought? Talmanis was looking at him. That was odd of you, Matt, the man said. What? Matt said. The restriction on the men? They're a good lot, the band, but I've never known a group of soldiers who weren't likely to get themselves in a little trouble now and then, particularly where there's ale to be found. I wasn't talking about the men, Matt, Talmanis said, bending to tap out his pipe against his stirrup, Dottle falling to flutter back onto the stony roadway beside his horse. I'm talking about how you treated the Aes Sedai. Light, Matt. We could have been rid of them. I'd count 20 horses and some coin a bargain to be free of 2 Aes Sedai. I won't be shoved around, Matt said stubbornly, waving for the band to begin its march again. Not even to get rid of Jolene. If she wants something from me, let her ask with a grain of politeness, rather than trying to bully me into giving her whatever she wants. I'm no lapdog. Burn it, he wasn't. And he wasn't husbandly either, whatever that meant. You really do miss her, Talmanis said, sounding a little surprised as their horses fell into pace beside one another. What are you blathering about now? Matt, you are not always the most refined of men, I'll admit. Sometimes your humor is indeed a bit ripe, and your tone on the brusque side. But you are rarely downright rude, nor intentionally insulting. You really are on edge, aren't you? Matt said nothing, just pulled the brim of his hat down again. I'm sure that she will be fine, Matt, Talmanis said, tone gentler. She is royalty. They know how to take care of themselves. And she's got those soldiers watching after her. Not to mention Ogier. Ogier warriors. Who would think of such a thing? She'll be all right. We're done with this conversation, Matt said, shifting his spear to hold it upright, curved blade toward the unseen sun above, butt in the lancer's strap at the side of his saddle. I just... Over, Matt said. You don't have any more of that tobak, do you? Talmanis sighed. It was the last pinch. Good tobak. 2 rivers grown. The only pouch of it I've seen in some time. It was a gift from King Roadrun, along with the pipe. He must have valued you. It was good, honest work, Talmanis said. And terribly boring. Not like riding with you, Matt.
It's good to have you back, crust and all. But your talk of feed with the Aes Sedai does have me worried. Matt nodded. How are we on rations?
Low, Tamanis said.
We'll buy what we can at the village, Matt said. We've got coin coming out our ears after what Rohedrin gave you. A small village wasn't likely to have enough to supply the whole army, but according to the maps, they'd soon be entering more populated lands. You'd pass a village or two every day in those areas, traveling with a quick force like the band. To stay afloat, you scavenged and bought whatever little you could at each village you passed. A wagon load here, a cart full there, a bucket or two of apples from a passing farmstead. 7,000 men was a lot to feed, but a good commander knew not to turn down even a handful of grain. It added up.
Yes, but will the villagers sell? Tamanis asked. On our way down to meet you, we had a savage time getting anyone to sell us food. Seems there isn't much to be found these days. Food is getting scarce no matter where you go, and no matter how much money you have.
Bloody perfect. Matt ground his teeth, then grew annoyed at himself for doing so. Well, maybe he was a little on edge. Not because of Tuon, though. Either way, he needed to relax. And that village ahead, what had Bannon called it? Hinder's Tap? How much coin do you have on you? Tamanis frowned.
Couple of gold marks, pouch full of silver crowns. Why?
Not enough, Matt said, rubbing his chin. We'll have to dig some more out of my personal chest first. Maybe bring the whole thing. He turned Pips around. Come on.
Wait, Matt, Tamanis said, reining in and following. What are we doing?
You're going to kindly take me up on my offer to go enjoy ourselves at the tavern, Matt said. And while we're at it, we're going to resupply. If my luck's with me, we'll do it for free. If Egwene or Nynaeve had been there, they'd have boxed his ears and told him he was going to do no such thing. Tuon probably would have looked at him curiously and then said something that made him feel his shame right down into his boots. The good thing about Tomanis, however, was that he simply spurred his horse forward, face stoic, eyes betraying just a hint of amusement.
Well, I've got to see this, then.
Chapter 21 Embers and Ash. Perrin opened his eyes and found himself hanging in the air. He felt a spike of terror floundering in the sky. Black clouds boiled overhead, dark and ominous. Below, a plain of wild brown grasses rolled in the wind, no signs of humans. No tents, no roads, not even any footprints. Perrin wasn't falling. He just hung there. He waved his arms reflexively as if to swim, panicking as his mind tried to make sense of the disorientation.
The wolf dream, he thought. I'm in the wolf dream. I went to sleep hoping to come here.
He forced himself to breathe in and out and still his flailing, though it was difficult to be calm while hanging hundreds of feet up in the sky. Suddenly, a gray-furred form shot past him, leaping through the air. The wolf soared down to the field below, landing easily.
Hopper! Jump down, young bull. Jump. It is safe.
As always, the sending from the wolf came as a mixture of scents and images. Perrin was getting better and better at interpreting those. The soft earth as a representation of the ground, rushing wind as an image of jumping, the scent of relaxation and calmness, to indicate there was no need to fear.
But how? Times before, you always rushed ahead, like a pup newly weaned. Jump. Jump down.
Far below, Hopper sat on his haunches in the field, grinning up at Perrin. Perrin ground his teeth and muttered a curse or two for stubborn wolves. It seemed to him that the dead ones were particularly bullheaded, though Hopper did have a point. Perrin had leaped before in this place, if never from the sky itself. He took a deep breath, then closed his eyes and imagined himself jumping. Air rushed around him in a sudden burst, but then his feet hit soft ground. He opened his eyes. A large gray wolf, scarred from many fights, was sitting on the ground beside him, and wild millet spread out in a broad plain around him, heavily mixed with stands of long, thin grasses that reached high in the air. Scratchy stalks rubbed against Perrin's arms in the wind, making him itch. The grasses smelled too dry, like cut hay left in a barn over the winter. Some things were transitory here in the wolf dream. Leaves lay in a pile by his feet at one moment, but then were gone the next. Everything smelled just faintly stale, as if it weren't quite there. He looked up. The sky was stormy. Normally, clouds in this place were as transitory as other things. It could be completely overcast, then in a blink it would suddenly be clear. This time, those dark storm clouds remained. They boiled, spun, and shot lines of lightning between different thunderheads. Yet the lightning never struck the ground, and it made no noise. The plain was oddly silent. The clouds shrouded the entire sky, ominous, and they did not leave. The last hunt comes. Hopper looked up at the sky. We will run together then, unless we sleep instead. Sleep, Perrin said. What of the last hunt? It comes, Hopper agreed. If Shadow Killer falls to the storm, all will sleep forever. If he lives, then we will hunt together, you and us. Perrin rubbed his chin, trying to sort through the sending of images, smells, sounds, feelings. It made little sense to him. But, well, he was here now. He'd wanted to come, and he'd decided that he'd get some answers from Hopper if he could. It was good to see Hopper again. Run, Hopper sent. His sending was not alarmed. It was an offer. Let us run together. Perrin nodded and began to jog through the grasses. Hopper loped beside him, sending amusement. Two legs, young bull? Two legs are slow. That sending was an image of men stumbling over themselves, tripping because of their elongated, silly legs. Perrin hesitated. I have to keep control, Hopper, he said. When I let the wolf take control, well, I do dangerous things. The wolf cocked his head, trotting beside Perrin across the grassy field. The stalks crunched and scraped as the two of them passed through, finding a small game trail, turning along it. Run, Hopper urged, obviously confused at Perrin's reluctance. I can't, Perrin said, stopping. Hopper turned and took a few bounds back to him. He smelled confused. Hopper, I frighten myself, Perrin said. When I lose control. The first time it happened to me was just after I met the wolves. You need to help me understand. Hopper simply continued to stare at him, tongue hanging out the front of his mouth just slightly, jaws parted. Why am I doing this? Perrin thought, shaking his head. Wolves didn't think like men. What did it matter what Hopper thought of it all? We will hunt together, Hopper sent. What if I don't want to hunt with you? Perrin said. Saying the words made his heart twist. He did like this place, the wolf dream, dangerous though it could be. There were wonderful things about what had happened to him since leaving the Two Rivers. But he couldn't continue to lose control. He had to find a balance. Throwing away the axe had made a difference. The axe and the hammer were different weapons. One could be used only for killing, while the other gave him a choice. But he had to make good on that choice. He had to control himself. And the first step seemed to be learning to control the wolf within him. Run with me, young bull, Hopper sent. Forget these thoughts. Run like a wolf. I can't, Perrin replied. He turned, scanning the plains. But I need to know this place, Hopper. I need to learn how to use it, control it. Men, Hopper thought, sending the smells of dismissiveness and anger. Control. Always control. I want you to teach me, Perrin said, turning back to the wolf. I want to master this place. Will you show me how? Hopper sat back on his haunches. Fine, Perrin said. I will search out other wolves who will. He turned, striking down the game trail. He didn't recognize this place, but he'd learned that the wolf dream was unpredictable. This meadow, with the waist-high grass and its stands of yew, could be anywhere. Where would he find wolves? He quested out with his mind and found that it was much more difficult to do here.
You don't want to run, but you look for wolves. Why are you so difficult, cub?
Hopper sat in front of him in the grass. Perrin grumbled, then took a leap that launched him through the air 100 yards. He landed with his foot falling to the grass as if it had been a normal step. And there Hopper was ahead of him. Perrin hadn't seen the wolf leap. He had been in one place and now in another. Perrin gritted his teeth, questing out again, for other wolves. He felt something distant. He needed to push harder. He concentrated, drew more strength into himself somehow, and managed to push his mind farther.
This is dangerous, young bull,
Hopper sent.
You come here too strongly. You will die.
You always say that, Perrin replied.
Tell me what I want to know. Show me how to learn. Stubborn pup,
Hopper sent.
Return when you aren't determined to poke your snout into a fire asp's den.
With that, something slammed against Perrin, a weight against his mind. Everything vanished, and he was tossed, like a leaf before a storm, out of the wolf dream.
Fail felt her husband stir next to her as he slept. She glanced at him in the dark room. Though she lay beside him on the pallet, she hadn't been sleeping. She'd been waiting, listening to his breaths. He turned onto his back, muttering drowsily. Of all the nights for him to be restless, she thought with annoyance. They were a week out of Malden. The refugees had made camp, or, well, camps, near a waterway that led straight to the Johanna Road, which was only a short distance away. Things had gone smoothly these last few days, though Perrin had judged the Ashaman too tired still to make gateways. She had spent the evening with her husband, reminding him of several important reasons why he'd married her in the first place. He'd certainly been enthusiastic, though there was that odd edge to his eyes. Not a dangerous edge, just a sorrowful one. He had grown haunted while they were apart. She could understand that. She had a few ghosts of her own. One could not expect everything to remain the same, and she could tell that he still loved her. Loved her fiercely. That was enough, and so she didn't worry on it further. But she was planning an argument that would pull his secrets from him. She would wait a few more days for that. It was good to remind a husband that one would not sit content with everything he did, but it wouldn't do to make him think she was unappreciative to have him back. Quite the opposite. She smiled, rolling over and laying her hand on his chest, furred with hair, her head on his bare shoulder. She loved this burly, tumbling avalanche of a man. Being back with him was sweeter even than the victory of her escape from the Shido. His eyes fluttered open and she sighed. Love him or not, she wished he'd remain asleep this night. Hadn't she tired him out enough? He looked at her. His golden eyes seemed to glow just faintly in the darkness, though she knew it was a trick of the light. Then he pulled her a little closer.
I didn't sleep with Berylaine, he said, voice gruff. No matter what the rumors say.
Dear, sweet, blunt Perrin. I know you didn't, she said consolingly. She'd heard the rumors. Virtually every woman she'd talked to in the camp, from Aes Sedai to servant, had pretended she was trying to hold her tongue, yet spilled the same news. Perrin, spending a night in the first of Mayenne's tent.
No, really, Perrin said, a pleading tone entering his voice. I didn't, Fail, please.
I said I believed you.
You sounded, I don't know. Burn it, woman, you sounded jealous.
Would he never learn? Perrin, she said flatly. It took me the better part of a year, not to mention considerable trouble, to seduce you. And then it only worked because there was a marriage involved. Verilane hasn't the skill to handle you. He reached his right hand up, scratching his beard, seeming confused. Then he just smiled. Besides, she added, snuggling closer, you spoke the words, and I trust you.
So you're not jealous?
Of course I am, she said, swatting his chest. Perrin, haven't I explained this? A husband needs to know his wife is jealous. Otherwise he won't realize how much she cares for him. You guard that which you find most precious. Honestly, if you keep making me spell things out like this, then I won't have any secrets left. He snorted softly at that last comment.
I doubt that's possible.
He grew quiet, and she closed her eyes, hoping he'd go back to sleep. Outside the tent, she could hear the distant voices of guards chatting on patrol, and the sound of one of the farriers, Jerisid, Imin, or Falton, working late into the night, pounding out a shoe or nail to ready one of the horses for the next day's march. It was good to hear that sound again. The Aiel were useless when it came to horses, and the Shido had either released the ones they captured or turned them into workhorses. She had seen many fine saddle mares pulling carts during her days in Malden. Should it feel strange to be back? She had spent less than 2 months as a captive, but it had seemed like years. Years spent running errands for Savannah, being punished arbitrarily. But that time had not broken her. Strangely, she'd felt more like a noblewoman during those days than she had before. It was as if she hadn't quite understood what it was to be a lady until Malden. Oh, she'd had her share of victories. Chafail, the people of the Two Rivers, Aleandra and Perrin's camp members. She'd put her training to use, helping Perrin learn to be a leader. All of this had been important, had required her to use what her mother and father had trained her to be. But Malden had opened her eyes. There she had found people who had needed her more than she'd ever been needed before. Beneath Savannah's cruel dictatorship, there'd been no time for games, no room for mistakes. She had been humiliated, beaten, and nearly killed. And that had given her a true understanding of what it was to be a liege lady. She actually felt a stab of guilt for the times she had lorded over Perrin, trying to force him or others to bend to her will. Being a noblewoman meant going first. It meant being beaten so others were not. It meant sacrificing, risking death, to protect those who depended upon you. No, it didn't feel strange to be back, for she'd taken Malden, the parts that mattered, with her. Hundreds had sworn allegiance to her among the Gai Shine, and she had saved them. She had done it through Perrin, but she had made plans, and one way or another she would have escaped and brought back an army to free those who had sworn to her. There had been costs, but she would deal with those later tonight, light willing. She opened an eye and peeked at Perrin. He seemed to be sleeping, but was his breath even? She slipped her arm free.
I don't care what happened to you, he said.
She sighed. No, not asleep. What happened to me? She asked with confusion. He opened his eyes, staring up at the tent.
The Shido. The man who was with you when I saved you. Whatever he did. Whatever you did to survive. It's all right.
Was that what was bothering him?
Light.
You big ox, she said, thumping a fist on his chest, causing him to grunt. What are you saying? That it would be all right for me to be unfaithful? Just after you were so concerned to tell me that you hadn't been?
What? No, it's different, Fael. You were a prisoner and
I can't care for myself? You are an ox. No one touched me. They're Aiel. You know they wouldn't dare harm a Gai Shine. It wasn't quite true. Women had often been abused in the Shido camp, for the Shido had stopped acting like Aiel. But there had been others in the camp, Aiel who hadn't been Shido, men who had refused to accept Rand as their Karakarn, but who also had trouble accepting Shido authority. The Brotherless had been men of honor, though they'd called themselves cast off. They had been the only ones in Malden who had maintained the old ways. When the Gai Shine women had started to be in danger, The Brotherless had chosen and protected those they could. They hadn't asked anything for their efforts. Well, that wasn't true. They had asked for much, but had demanded nothing. Roland had always been an Aiel to her in action, if not in word. But like Massima's death, her relationship with Roland was not something Perrin needed to know about. She had never so much as kissed Roland, but she had used his desire for her as an advantage, and she suspected that he'd known what she was doing. Perrin had killed Roland. That was another reason that her husband didn't need to know about the Brotherless man's kindness. It would tear Perrin apart inside if he knew what he'd done. Perrin relaxed, closing his eyes. He had changed during these 2 months, perhaps as much as she had. That was good. In the Borderlands, her people had a saying, "Only the Dark One stays the same." Men grew and progressed. The Shadow just remained as it was. Evil.
"We'll have to do some planning tomorrow," Perrin said, yawning. "Once gateways are available, we will have to decide whether to force the people to leave and decide who goes first. Has anyone discovered what happened to Massima?"
"Not that I know of," she said carefully. "But with so many of his possessions gone from his tent..."
"Massima doesn't care about possessions,"
Perrin mumbled quietly, eyes still closed.
"Though maybe he would have taken them to rebuild. I guess he might have run off, though it's strange that nobody knows where or how."
"He probably slipped away during the confusion after the battle."
"Probably,"
Perrin agreed.
"I wonder," he yawned, "I wonder what Rand will say. Massima was the point of this whole trip. I was to fetch him and bring him back. I guess I failed."
"You destroyed the men who were murdering and robbing in the dragon's name," Fael said, "and you cut out the heart of the Shido leadership, not to mention all you've learned about the Seanchan. I think the dragon will find that what you've accomplished here far outweighs not bringing Massima back."
"Maybe you're right," Perrin mumbled sleepily. "Blasted colors. I don't want to watch you sleeping, Rand.
What happened to your hand?"
"Like blinded fool, take better care of yourself. You're all we have. Last hunt coming."
She could barely make out that last part. Why was he talking about Rand's hand going hunting? Was he actually falling asleep this time? Sure enough, he soon started snoring softly. She smiled, shaking her head fondly. He was an ox sometimes, but he was her ox. She climbed off of the pallet and moved through their tent, pulling on a robe and tying its belt. A pair of sandals followed, and then she slipped out through the tent flaps. Arala and Lasiel guarded there along with two maidens. The maidens nodded to her. They would keep her secret. Fael left the maiden guards, but took Arala and Lasiel with her as she walked out into the darkness. Arala was a dark-haired Tyran woman, who was taller than most maidens, with a brusque way about her. Lasiel was short, pale, and very slender, and she walked with a graceful sway. They were as different as women could get, perhaps, though their captivity had united them all. Both members of Chafail had been captured with her and gone to Malden as Geishine. After traveling a short distance, they picked up two other maidens. Bane and Chiad had spoken with them lightly. They passed out of the camp, moving to a spot where a pair of willow trees stood side by side. There, Fael was met by a pair of women who still wore Geishine white. Bane and Chiad were maidens themselves, first sisters, and dear to Fael. They were more loyal, even, than those who had sworn to her. Loyal to her, yet free of oaths to her. A contradiction only Aiel could pull off. Unlike Fael and the others, Bane and Chiad would not put off the white just because their captors had been defeated. They would wear the clothing for a year and a day. In fact, coming here this night, acknowledging their lives from before they had been taken, stretched what their honor would allow. However, they admitted that being Geishine in the Shido camp had been anything but standard. Fael met them with a smile, but did not shame them by calling them by name or by using maiden hand talk. However, she couldn't keep herself from asking, "You are well?" as she accepted a small bundle from Chiad. Chiad was a beautiful woman with gray eyes and short, reddish-blonde hair hidden beneath the hood of her Gaishine robe. She grimaced at the question. "Gaul searched the entire Shido camp to find me, and reports say he defeated 12 Algai de Siswai with his spear. Perhaps I shall have to make a bridal wreath for him after all, once this is all through." Fael smiled. Chiad smiled back. He did not expect that one of the men he killed would turn out to be the one to whom Bane was Gaishine. I do not think Gaul is happy to have both of us serving him. Foolish man. Bane, the taller of the two, said. Very like him, to not watch where he jabbed his spear. He couldn't kill the right man without accidentally slaying a few others. Both women chuckled. Fael smiled and nodded. Aiel's humor was beyond her. Thank you very much for fetching these, she said, holding up the small cloth-wrapped bundle. It was nothing, Chiad said. There were too many hands working that day, so it was easy. Aleandra Maritha Kigarin already waits for you at the trees. We should return to the camp. Yes, Bane added. Perhaps Gaul would like his back rubbed again, or water fetched for him. He grows so angry when we ask. But Gaishine gain honor only through service. What else are we to do? The women laughed again, and Fael shook her head as they ran back toward the camp, white robes swishing. She cringed at the thought of having to wear such clothing again, if only because it made her think about her days of service to Savannah. Lanky Arala and graceful Lasiel joined her at the base of the two willows. The maiden guards stayed behind, watching from afar. A third maiden joined those two, moving out of the shadows, likely sent by Bane and Chiad to protect Aleandra. Fael found the dark-haired queen standing at the base of the trees, looking like a lady again in a rich red gown with golden chains lacing her hair. It was an extravagant display, as if she were determined to disprove the days she'd spent acting as a servant. Aleandra's gown made Fael more aware of her simple robe, but there wasn't much she could have done without waking Perrin. Arala and Lasiel wore only the embroidered breeches and shirts common to those in Chaf Fael. Aleandra carried a small lantern with the shutters drawn, letting out only a crack of light that illuminated her youthful face, topped by dark hair. "Did they find anything?" she asked. "Please tell me that they did." She'd always been impressively grounded for a queen, if somewhat demanding. Her time in Malden appeared to have tempered the latter feature. "Yes." Fael hefted the bundle. The four women huddled around her as she knelt on the ground, the tips of the short grass lit by the lantern, shining like tongues of flame. Fael unwrapped the bundle. The contents weren't anything extraordinary. A small handkerchief of yellow silk, a belt of worked leather which had a pattern of bird feathers pressed into its sides, a black veil, and a thin leather band with a stone tied at the center. "That belt belonged to Kinwin," Aleandra said, pointing to it. "I saw him wearing it before..." She trailed off, then knelt and picked it up. "The veil is that of a maiden," Arala said. "They're different?" Aleandra asked with surprise. "Of course they are," Arala said, picking up the veil. Fael had never met the maiden who had become Arala's protector, but the woman had fallen in the battle, though not as dramatically as Roland and the others. The piece of silk was Juridan's. Lasiel hesitated, then took it in her hands, turning it over and revealing that there was a spot of blood on it. That left only the leather cord. Roland had worn it at his neck, on occasion, beneath his cut-in sore. Fael wondered what it had meant to him, and if there was any significance to the single bit of stone, a rough-cut chunk of turquoise. She picked it up, then glanced at Lasiel. Surprisingly, the slender woman seemed to be crying. Because Lasiel had gone so quickly to the hefty brotherless's bed, Fail had assumed that her relationship with him had been one of necessity, not affection. 4 people are dead, Fail said, mouth suddenly dry. She spoke formally, for that was the best way to keep the emotion from her voice. They protected us, even cared for us. Though they were the enemy, we mourn them. Remember, though, that they were Aiel. For an Aiel, there are far worse ends than death in combat. The others nodded, but Lasiel met Fail's eyes. For the two of them, it was different. When Perrin had barreled out of that alleyway, roaring in anger at seeing Fail and Lasiel apparently being manhandled by Shido, many things had happened very quickly. In the fray, Fail had distracted Roland at just the right moment, making him hesitate. He'd done so out of concern for her, but that pause had allowed Perrin to kill him. Had Fail done it intentionally? She still didn't know. So much had been going through her mind, so many emotions at seeing Perrin. She'd cried out, and she could not decide if she'd been trying to distract Roland to let him die by Perrin's hand. For Lasiel, there was no such wavering. Jorodin had leapt in front of her, putting her behind him and raising his weapon against the intruder. She'd put a knife in his back, killing a man for the first time in her life. And it had been a man whose bed she'd shared. Fail had killed Kinwin, the other member of the Brotherless who had protected them. He wasn't the first man whose life she had taken, nor the first one she'd taken from behind, but he was the first man she'd killed who had seen her as a friend. There was nothing else that could have been done. Perrin had seen only Shido, and the Brotherless had seen only an invading enemy. That conflict could not have ended without Perrin or the Brotherless dead. No amount of screaming would have stopped any of the men. But that made it more tragic. Fail steeled herself to keep her eyes from tearing up like Lasiel's. She hadn't loved Roland, and she was glad that Perrin was the one who had survived the conflict. But Roland had been an honorable man, and she felt dirtied, somehow, that his death had been her fault. This shouldn't have had to be, but it was. Her father had often spoken of situations like this, when you had to kill people you liked just because you met them on the wrong side of the battlefield. She'd never understood. If she had to go back and do it again, she would take the very same actions. She wouldn't be able to risk Perrin. Roland had had to die. But the world seemed a sadder place to her for the necessity of it. Lasiel turned away, sniffling softly. Fail knelt, taking a small flask of oil from the bundle Chiad had left. She took the leather strap and pulled off the stone, then set the strap in the center of the cloth bundle. She poured the oil on it, then used a tinder stick, lit at the lantern, to set the strap afire. She watched it burn, tiny little flames of blue and green topped by orange. The scent of burning leather was shockingly similar to that of burning human flesh. The night was still, no wind to shake the flames, and so they danced freely. Aleandra doused the belt and put it onto the miniature fire. Arala did the same with the veil. Finally, Lasiel added the handkerchief. She was still crying. This was all they could do. There hadn't been a way to see to the bodies in the chaos of leaving Malden. Chiad had said there was no dishonor in leaving them, but Fail had needed to do something. Some small way of honoring Roland and the others. Dead by our hand, Fail said. Or simply dead from battle. These 4 showed us honor. As the Aiel would say, we have great toe to them. I don't think it can be repaid. But we can remember them. The Brotherless and one maiden showed us kindness when they didn't need to. They kept their honor when others had abandoned it. If there is a redemption to be found for them and for us, this will be it. There's a Brotherless in Perrin's camp, Lasiel said, eyes reflecting the flames of their pyre. Niagan is his name. He is Gaishain to Sulin, the maiden. I went to tell him of what the others did for us. He is a kind man. Fail closed her eyes. Lasiel probably meant that she had gone to the bed of this Niagan. That wasn't forbidden of Gaishain. You can't replace Juradin like that, she said, opening her eyes. Or undo what you did. I know, Lucille said defensively. But they were so full of humor, despite the terrible situation. There was something about them. Juradin wanted to take me back to the Threefold Land, make me his wife. And you'd never have done it, Fael thought. I know you wouldn't have. But now that he's dead, you realize the opportunity you lost. Well, who was she to chastise? Let Lucille do as she wished. If this Niagan was half the man that Roland or the others had been, then perhaps Lucille would do well with him. Kinwin had only just started looking out for me, Alejandra said. I know what he wished for, but he never demanded it. I think he was planning to leave the Shido, and would have helped us escape. Even if I turned him down, he would have helped us. Marthea hated what the other Shido did, Arala said. But she stayed with them for her clan. She died for that loyalty. There are worse things to die for. Fael watched the last embers of the miniature pyre flicker out. I think Roland actually loved me, she said. And that was all. The four rose and returned to the camp. The past was a field of embers and ash, an old Saldean proverb said, the remnants of the fire that was the present. Those embers blew away behind her, but she kept Roland's turquoise stone. Not for regret, but for remembrance.
Perrin lay awake in the still night, smelling the canvas of his tent and the unique scent of Fael. She wasn't there, though she had been recently. He'd dozed off, and now she was gone, perhaps to the privy. He stared up in the darkness, trying to make sense of Hopper and the wolf dream. The more he thought about it, the more determined he grew. He would march to the last battle, and when he did, he wanted to be able to control the wolf inside of him. He wanted either to be free of all these people who followed him, or to learn how to accept their loyalty. He had some decisions to make. They wouldn't be easy, but he'd make them. A man had to do hard things. That was the way of life. That was what had gone wrong with the way he'd handled Fael's capture. Instead of making decisions, he'd avoided them. Master Luhan would have been disappointed in him. And that led Perrin to another decision, the hardest of all. He was going to have to let Fael ride into danger, perhaps risk her again. Was that a decision? Could he make such a decision? The mere thought of her in danger made him want to sick up, but he would have to do something. Three problems. He would face them, and he would decide. But he would consider them first, because that was what he did. A man was a fool to make decisions without thinking first. But the decision to face his problems brought him a measure of peace, and he rolled over and drifted back to sleep.
Chapter 22. The Last That Could Be Done. Semirag sat alone in the small room. They had taken away her chair and given her no lantern or candle. Blast this cursed age and its cursed people. What she would have given for glow bulbs on the walls. During her days, prisoners hadn't been denied light. Of course, she had locked several of her experiments away in total darkness, but that was different. It had been important to discover what effect the lack of light would have on them. These so-called Aes Sedai who held her, they had no rational reason for leaving her in darkness. They just did it to humiliate her. She pulled her arms closer, huddling against the wooden wall. She did not cry. She was of the Chosen. So what if she had been forced to abase herself? She was not broken. But the fool Aes Sedai no longer regarded her as they had. Semirag hadn't changed, but they had. Somehow in one swoop that cursed woman with the paralysis net in her hair had unraveled Semirag's authority with the entire lot of them. How? How had she lost control so quickly? She shuddered as she remembered being turned over the woman's knees and spanked. And the nonchalance of it! The only emotion in the woman's voice had been a slight annoyance. She'd treated Semirag, one of the chosen, as if she were barely worthy of notice. That had galled more than the blows. It would not happen again. Semirag would be ready for the blows next time, and she would give them no weight. Yes, that would work. Wouldn't it? She shuddered again. She had tortured hundreds, perhaps thousands, in the name of understanding and reason. Torture made sense. You truly saw what a person was made of in more ways than one when you began to slice into them. That was a phrase she'd used on numerous occasions. It usually made her smile. This time it did not. Why couldn't they have given her pain? Broken fingers, cuts into her flesh, coals in the pits of her elbows. She had steeled her mind to each of these things, preparing for them. A small, eager part of herself had looked forward to them. But this? Being forced to eat food off the floor? Being treated like a child in front of those who had regarded her with such awe? I will kill her, she thought, not for the first time. I will remove her tendons one at a time, using the power to heal her so that she lives to experience the pain. No. No, I'll do something new to her. I will show her agony that hasn't been known to anyone in any age. Semirag. A whisper. She froze, looking up in the darkness. That voice had been soft, like a chill wind, yet still sharp and biting. Had she imagined it? He couldn't be there, could he? You have failed greatly, Semirag, the voice continued, so soft. A faint light shone underneath the door, but the voice came from inside her cell. The light seemed to grow brighter, and it flushed a deep red, illuminating the hem of a figure in a black cloak standing before her. She looked up. The ruddy light revealed a face of white, the color of dead skin. The face had no eyes. She immediately knelt to the floor, prostrating herself on the aged wood. Though the figure before her looked like a murdral, it was much taller and much, much more important. She shivered as she remembered the voice of the great lord himself speaking to her. When you obey Shaidar Haran, you obey me. When you disobey... You were to capture the boy, not kill him, the figure whispered in a hiss, like steam escaping through cracks between pot and lid. You took his hand and nearly his life. You have revealed yourself and have lost valuable pawns. You have been captured by our enemies, and now they have broken you. She could hear the smile on its lips. Shaidar Haran was the only murdral she had ever seen bear a smile. But then she did not think this thing was truly a murdral. She did not reply to its charges. One did not lie or even make excuses before this figure. Suddenly the shield blocking her vanished, her breath caught. Shaidar had returned. Sweet power. However, as she reached for it, she hesitated. Those imitation eyes Sedai outside would feel it if she channeled. A cold, long-nailed hand touched her chin. The flesh of it felt like dead leather. It rotated her face upward to meet the eyeless gaze. You have been given one last chance, the maggot-like lips whispered. Do not fail. The light faded. The hand at her chin withdrew. She continued to kneel, fighting down terror. One last chance. The great lord always rewarded failure in imaginative ways. She had given such rewards before and had no desire to receive them. They would make any torture or punishment these eyes Sedai could imagine look childish. She forced herself to her feet, feeling her way around the room. She reached the door, and holding her breath, tried it. The door opened. She slipped out of the room without letting the hinges creak. Outside, three corpses lay on the ground, slumped free of their chairs. The women who had been maintaining her shield. There was someone else there, kneeling on the ground before the three of them. one of the Aes Sedai. A woman in green with brown hair pulled back into a tail, her head bowed.
I live to serve, Great Mistress, the woman whispered. I'm instructed to tell you that there is compulsion in my mind you are to remove.
Semirag raised an eyebrow. She hadn't realized there were any of the black among those Aes Sedai here. Removing compulsion could have a very nasty effect on a person. Even if the compulsion were weak or subtle, the brain could be harmed seriously by removing it. If the compulsion were strong, well, it was quite interesting to watch. Also, the woman said, handing something forward wrapped in cloth,
I am to give you this.
She removed the cloth, revealing a dull-colored metallic collar and two bracelets. The domination band. Crafted during the breaking, strikingly similar to the Adam Semirag had spent so much time working with. With this Terangreal, a male channeler could be controlled. A smile finally broke through Semirag's fear.
Rand had only visited the Blight on a single occasion, though he could faintly remember having come to this area on several occasions before the Blight infected the land. Luz Theron's memories, not his own. The madman took to hissing and muttering angrily as they rode through the Saldaean scrub. Even Tidarshar grew skittish as they moved northward. Saldaea was a browned landscape of brushland and dark soil, nowhere near as barren as the Aiel Waste, but hardly a soft or lush land. Homesteads were common, but they had nearly the look of forts, and young children held themselves like trained warriors. Lan had once told him that among borderlanders, a boy became a man when he earned the right to carry a sword.
Has it occurred to you, Iteralda said, riding on Rand's left, that what we are doing here could constitute an invasion?
Rand nodded toward Bashir, who rode through the brush at Rand's right.
I bring with me troops of their own blood, he said. The Saldaeans are my allies.
Bashir laughed.
I doubt that the Queen will see it that way, my friend. It's been many months since I last asked her for orders. Why, I wouldn't be surprised to find that she's demanded my head by now.
Rand turned his eyes forward. I am the Dragon Reborn. It is not an invasion to march against the forces of the Dark One. Ahead of them rose the foothills of the Mountains of Doom. They had a dark cast, as if their slopes were coated with soot. What would he himself do if another monarch used a gateway to deposit nearly 50,000 troops within his borders? It was an act of war, but the Borderlanders' forces were away doing light only knew what, and he would not leave these lands undefended. Just an hour's ride to the south, Iteralda's Domani had set up a fortified camp beside a river that had its source up in the highlands of World's End. Rand had inspected their camp and ranks. After that, Bashir had suggested that Rand ride up to inspect the Blight. The scouts had been surprised at how quickly the Blight was advancing, and Bashir thought it important that Iteralda and Rand see for themselves. Rand agreed. Maps sometimes couldn't convey the truth. Eyes could see. The sun was dipping toward the horizon like a drooping eye longing for sleep. Tidaishar stamped a hoof, tossing his head. Rand raised a hand, halting his group. Two generals, 50 soldiers, and an equal number of maidens, with Narishma at the back to weave gateways. Northward, on the shallow slope, a scrub of broad-bladed grasses and squat brush swayed like waves in the wind. There was no specific line where the Blight began. A spot on a blade there, a sickly cast to a stem there. Each individual speck was innocent, yet there were too many. Far too many. At the top of the hillside, not a single plant was free of the spots. The pox seemed to fester even as he watched. There was an oily sense of death to the Blight, of plants barely surviving, kept alive like prisoners, starved to the very edge of mortality. If Rand had seen anything like this back in a field in the Two Rivers, he would have burnt the entire crop, and would have been surprised that it hadn't been done already. To his side, Bashir knuckled his long dark mustaches.
I remember when it didn't start for another 2 leagues, he noted. That wasn't so long ago.
I have patrols running the length of it already, Iteralda said. He stared out at the sickly landscape. All the reports are the same. It's quiet out there. That should be enough warning that something is wrong, Bashir said. There are always patrols or raids of Trollocs to fight. If not that, then something worse to scare them away. Worms or blood rasps. Iteralda leaned one arm on his saddle, shaking his head as he continued staring at the blight. I've no experience with fighting such things. I know how men think, but Trolloc raiding parties keep no supply lines, and I've only heard stories of what worms can do. I will leave some of Bashir's officers with you as advisors, Rand said. That would help, Iteralda said. But I wonder if it wouldn't be better to just leave him here. His soldiers could patrol this area, and you could use my troops in Ar-Adaman. No offense, my lord, but don't you think it's odd to have us working in each other's kingdoms? No, Rand said. It wasn't odd, it was bitter sense. He trusted Bashir, and the Saldaeans had served Rand well, but it would be dangerous to leave them in their own homelands. Bashir was cousin to the queen herself, and what of his men? How would they react when their own people asked why they had become dragon-sworn? Strange as it was, Rand knew that he would cause a much smaller